Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Dog and Duck Show. My name is Warren Maynard. I am the dog, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Mark Schmoor. He is the duck. Mark, how are you doing, my friend?
I am basking in the glow of Peyton Pritchard, Warren. I'm doing great. Happy to have an Oregon Duck playing in the NBA Finals for the first time in I don't know how long, so excellent.
Peyton Pritchard. He almost outscored the entire Miami Heat starting lineup in game five of the series between the Heat and the Celtics. I think the entire starting lineup scored, I believe it was either 18 or 19 points. And in that game, Peyton Pritchard scored 14. So pretty impressive. Well, we're going to talk some NBA. We're going to get into this Warriors-Celtics final. But before we do, as we always do, let's talk a little dog and duck news. And for our listening audience, we didn't get a chance to do the podcast last week. We had some personal things come up. So some of the news that I'm going to share is a little bit dated, but it's not been discussed here on the show. So just some good news for the dogs. Maybe some not so good news that has come in recently, but the Huskies finally score a couple of wins in the recruiting department last week, getting a commitment. Mark, get this, from a 2025 recruit, supposedly a five-star, LaMason Waller, 6'2", 170-pound wide receiver. And he just finished his freshman year of high school. So I'm guessing he's 13, 14 years old.
I would think if he's finished his freshman year, he should be 15 years old, right?
Maybe he's 14.
15, 16, 17, 18. Like that's
true. Yeah. So I think just on a general level, Mark, in the age of NIL, what is the likelihood of any kid committing to any school coming off of his freshman year of high school that he's going to be able to resist the temptations to look elsewhere for the next 2.5 years?
I mean, are we even sure he stays at the same high school for the next 2.5 years? Like, you know, that would be my first question for a guy that's talented enough to be getting scholarship offers at age 15. Is like, you know, he's probably going to transfer to another high school, you know, reopen his recruitment. It's fascinating that they're getting in early on this guy, and maybe that will pay off. But you can't be putting that much hope that you're going to maintain that sort of commitment for that long in this day and age.
It certainly calls to mind for me memories of the Steve Sarkisian offer to Tate Martell. Does that name ring a bell? Mm-hmm. He committed to the Huskies when he was in eighth grade. And between the time that he committed to the Huskies, graduated from high school, I think he changed his commitment three times. And then he ended up going to, I think, at least three other colleges after making his commitment. So, and that was all before the era of NIL and the transfer portal. So, you know, it's a fun thing to high five and celebrate, but to imagine that this five-star recruit for 2025 is going to be able to hold off for 2.5 years. It reminds me of, this is probably about 10, 11 years ago, Mark, there was a TV show that came out during the boom of reality TV shows. Maybe you remember seeing this commercial, but it was for a TV show called Temptation Island. So, you know, the premise of the show, you put a bunch of attractive men and a bunch of attractive women on the show and somehow on an island, and somehow they have to resist the temptation to, you know, fall all over one another. And in the promo of the show, One of the men looks straight into the camera and he says, "I just wasn't expecting this level of temptation."
From a show titled Temptation Island.
From a show titled Temptation Island. So I kind of feel that's the case with this five star in 2025. But more realistically, the Huskies did get a commitment from 2023 four-star wide receiver Rashid Williams. Again, 6'2", run 190 pounds. And this is really the first legitimate four-star recruit that the Huskies have gotten since Kalen DeBoer came on board that you could really say is a DeBoer recruit. We had Kate Otten's younger brother, Ryan Otten, in the boat. We were able to keep him in the boat. But this is the first four-star that we've been able to get. And it makes me wonder with these two recruits, if wide receivers coach Jamarcus Shepherd is the equivalent to the Jimmy Lake under Chris Peterson, when, you know, Chris Peterson shows up, he's got Jimmy Lake, this dynamic, young, engaging, defensive backs coach that seems to win more recruiting battles than he loses. Is Jamarcus Shepherd going to be that guy? Only time will tell, but this looks like he could be that type of a coach and a recruiting force for the Huskies.
Well, if nothing else, you know, by landing all of these guys, Lamison Waller, am I pronouncing that name right?
LeMason? No, I think it's LeMason, but yeah.
LeMason Waller, so he's 15 now, just finished his freshman year. If he does maintain that commitment, by the time he's at the University of Washington, there's a chance Sam Heward may be starting.
You know? This is true.
So yeah. They're building up that receiving core to, you know, when they finally give the car keys to Sam.
You know, and that's actually a great point, because Sam actually committed to the Huskies during his freshman year of high school. Now, granted, he was a legacy recruit. Everybody kind of felt like he was in the boat, in the bag from the beginning. And he never wavered from that, but it's created this really uniquely long runway of expectation.
Right.
That although he's only entering into his second year, his redshirt freshman year, it feels like we've been talking about Sam Heward for half a decade, because we have.
Yeah. And I would think the difference, in addition to being the legacy recruit, he's also, he was from the area. I think if LeMason Waller was from the Seattle area, I'd put a little more stock into this, but he's from Southern California. Like, are we really think if Lincoln Riley comes calling in the next 2 years that he's not going to, you know, listen to that? That's hard for me to.
It's a hard sell for sure. But we'll take the W, as temporary as it might be. So, Mark, that's really all I've got right now for dog news. Anything happening in the world of duck news other than your beloved Peyton Pritchard?
No, well, you know, it is that time of year where we've got the NCAA tournament in both softball and baseball. So the Lady Ducks made it to the softball tournament, and they got eliminated by Arkansas over the weekend. And now the Ducks baseball team is getting ready. They're headed to Louisville to start their tournament this weekend. So it will be interesting to see how they can do. But I came across an interesting stat, Warren. You are gonna love this stat. It is among Power Five schools, teams that did not qualify for a football bowl game, an NCAA basketball tournament, or an NCAA baseball tournament, somehow went 0-3. Okay, now two of those are Syracuse and Colorado. They don't actually have baseball programs, so that's kind of a different category. So there's four teams that have teams in all three sports managed to fail for postseason play in all three. Nebraska Cornhuskers, the Northwestern Wildcats, the California Bears, and the Washington Huskies. Quite the Mount Rushmore to be included on.
I don't see how you thought I would like this statistic. Feels like you may be being a little passive aggressive in your in your tone.
We've got 12 schools on that list of six teams, though. That's incredible. Couple schools from the Pac-12 North and Cal and Washington. So that's really all I've got.
The Fire Jen Cohen chants are only going to get louder as that one gets rubbed in the faces of dog fans by Ducks down south. So who knows? Maybe that's the nail in the coffin for Jen Cohen. All right, well, let's move on. Let's talk a little bit of NBA action. So the last we spoke, the Warriors were facing the Mavericks. They closed out that series in five games. And then just this past Sunday night, the Celtics take down the Miami Heat in Miami in game seven to set up this series between the Warriors and the Celtics. So Mark, just first of all, first impressions, what was your takeaway from the Celtics winning in Miami in game seven?
Well, it felt like one of those series of how has this gone seven games? You know, you mentioned the game in which Peyton Pritchard almost single-handedly outscored Miami. Miami through five games looked like the Walking Dead. I mean, they did not look like any version of the team that was the best team in the East through the regular season. And it really just looked like it was, you know, the Celtics were going to close them out at home in game six and that would be the end of story. And then Miami battles back. They take game six. Jimmy Butler was extraordinary, had 47 points. After PJ Tucker came up to him in the locker room before the game and said, "We need 50 from you tonight." And he goes out and he doesn't quite give him 50, but he gives him 47. And then Butler was extraordinary also in game seven, right up until the very end, missed the three pointer that could have given Miami the lead in the final 30 seconds. So I came away from that much more impressed with Miami's grit and toughness. But I think, when we spoke about kind of the final four being set, I thought the Celtics were the clear favorite. I'm softer on the Celtics now. I thought there were some red flags with how difficult it was for them to close out Miami in this series. And so I think it should be competitive, but I have more doubts about the Celtics than I did a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I think that game seven, the Celtics had the lead from start to finish in that game. And there were times when they were up by, 15, 18 points, and the Heat would creep back into around three, and then that lead would expand again. But for Jimmy Butler to have a wide open three in transition with, I think, about 18 seconds left to take the lead, I mean, that should have never been the case. I think Miami was on an 11-0 run at that point. So I think you're right. The Celtics definitely have proven that they've got the goods to play championship level basketball. And I think that they're going to give the Warriors, plenty of competition, but there's certainly some question about whether or not they've got that killer instinct to put a team away, especially when the Heat really were not playing well at all for most of the series, aside from, as you mentioned, Jimmy Butler. Let's talk a little bit about the Warriors. And this is such a fascinating story to me. The Warriors have this tremendous dynastic run, and then it seemingly kind of fizzles out and comes to an end. They don't make the playoffs 2 years ago. Last year, they lose both of their play-in games. But this year, the you know, the team, the band is kind of finally back together again. Klay Thompson comes back halfway through the season, only for Draymond Green to get injured. Then when Green comes back, Curry's out for the last month. Now we finally see this team kind of all coming together with this really unique collection to me, Mark, of these three bona fide championship superstars in Curry, Green, and Klay, who have played in six NBA championships series. And then you've got these three younger guys who can kind of provide the juice maybe that they need in Wiggins and Loney and Poole. And so, you know, or Looney, sorry. And it seems like this is a team that's primed to just kind of steamroll its way through this NBA championship, but maybe I'm missing something. What do you think?
Well, I wouldn't go that far just because Boston does have the best defense in the NBA and like a historically good defense. And they've had some success against the Warriors. So I think anytime you're bringing, and now the Warriors have like a top three defense themselves. It's not like the Warriors don't play defense. It's kind of people kind of forget about this with how potent the Warriors are offensively, that they've throughout the Steve Kerr era always had elite defenses. And that's
and speaking of that, I mean, this is the first time that the two top defensive teams have met up in the NBA championship since Steve Kerr, Michael Jordan, and the Chicago Bulls and the Seattle Supersonics Gary Payton.
Yeah.
Which, you know, ironically, one of the storylines of this series could be the return of Gary Payton II,
right?
Coming in as that defensive specialist.
Yeah.
To try to, you know, thwart the Celtics, I would presume, Jaylen Brown as a defensive shutdown guy.
Yeah. So I think that with that in mind, I think that there is like, you figure in the first four games, each team is going to have one game at home where all of their role players are hitting.
Mm-hmm.
They're just kind of on a roll. And so then it comes down to the one game that they have at home, that each team will have at home, where they're getting pushed a little bit and the game is a little bit ugly. Mm-hmm. And I would tend to think that with the Warriors, kind of their championship DNA, with how they can turn a game so quickly with, you know, they can shoot poorly all game and then they can throw a 15-2 run on you and end mm-hmm. it like that. Like, and they're not going to be rattled, you know, late in situations the way that maybe a younger team might. So I would think all of that would favor the Warriors, but it doesn't make me favor the Warriors to the extent that I'm like, oh, wrap this series up, the Warriors are good. Because the Celtics play such good defense, I think they're going to be in a lot of games. And I think there are going to be a lot of games that are going to come down to the last 5 minutes and who can get a stop, who can get a rebound, who gets a key shot with the shot clock running down. And so, you know, it's very easy for me to conceive of a way in which, you know, we're back here previewing game five or game six, and either one of these teams kind of looks like they're in control of the series just because a couple bounces go their way. I think it'll be relatively competitive series.
So Mark, you know, I think certainly there's no reason why this couldn't go five or six games, even if Golden State is clearly the better team, because like you said, all it takes is a home game here or there for the Celtics to, you know, get a win and kind of stretch things out a little bit. But how much of a factor do you think it is that, number one, as we already mentioned, these three superstars are finally really getting back into the swing of things as a unit?
Yeah.
Then factoring in that Gary Payton II, Andre Iguodala, yeah, Otto Porter Jr. are all slated to come back. That's going to give them their full depth of roster. It's going to give them a lot more minutes to kind of, you know, divvy up and give them a lot more defensive type of, you know, situational type schemes that they can run. How much of a factor do you think that's going to have in this series?
Well, the Warriors are definitely the deeper team, and they trust everyone on their bench in a way that is unique. This is something that Steve Kerr, being a bench player his whole life, has been intent on, is that there is no such thing as a bench warmer on the Golden State Warriors. Like, if you're on the Warriors and you've sat out three or four games in a row and not played, then Steve Kerr will put you in the second quarter of a playoff game just to get you some minutes and keep you engaged. Mm-hmm. As his theory is, when I call on you because somebody goes down with an injury and we have to put you in a tight spot, we don't want you acting like you haven't been there before.
Right.
So he plays everyone. Maybe not everyone every game, but you know, if you look at up their roster, every single guy has played important minutes at some point in one of their playoff series. And the Celtics, I don't think, have nearly the level of trust in their bench. And whereas the Warriors are kind of getting guys back from injury, the Celtics, you know, Robert Williams, who's kind of their big shot blocker, rebounder inside, has some lingering issues, injury issues that seem to affect him in the Miami series and may, you know, linger on throughout the finals. And so I think you're right. I think getting all of those guys back and healthy, assuming that, you know, they can all contribute, that certainly will help. And, you know, the Warriors have kind of always operated from this strength in numbers mindset that they just kind of feel like we're going to bring more guys. And it's an interesting theory. In the NBA oftentimes doesn't operate that way, but that's how they operate. And so that could absolutely kind of swing the series. I think if you look at Dallas, at the series against Dallas, there were games where, like, Luka and Jalen Brunson thoroughly outscored Stephen Clay at the top.
Right.
But then the difference was, like, the 5, 6, 7, 8 guys on the roster. When Kevon Looney is scoring 21 points and nobody from Dallas at the back end of their rotation is giving them anything like that, totally swing a series.
Yeah, and that brings up kind of the question that I had is that, and we'll talk about the Celtics in just a minute, but if you are the Celtics as a defensive-minded team, what do you think is the winning approach for the Celtics? Is it to try to shut down Curry and Clay and risk running, you know, Wiggins scoring 27, Looney scoring, you know, 21, Poole scoring 24, you know, those kind of numbers? Or do you say, hey, we're going to make Steph Curry beat us and, you know, really lock down the kind of the additional players and maybe not double Steph, you know, as much as they might want to? Where do you think the winning approach is on that?
So the Celtics are known for switching, for having great switchability, because they have so many different defenders that are all kind of similar size. They can switch really easily. And so they don't seem to be too concerned about matchups. And yet it seems like when they've played the Warriors in the past, that they have basically put Marcus Smart on Steph Curry and not wanted to switch off there, of just kind of that Smart is going to try to hound Curry and make his life miserable. And Marcus Smart was the defensive player of the year this year, the first, you know, small guard or the first point guard since Gary Payton to win that award. So he seems like the perfect kind of guy to just kind of make life difficult for Steph. I think how the Warriors present kind of a math problem for their opponents is that even when Steph is having an off game, or even when Steph is simply running off screens and not getting the ball, he's creating angles and creating opportunities for his teammates. So in their closeout game against the Mavericks, I think Steph was like 5 for 19 shooting. He did not have a great shooting performance at all. Yeah. And the Warriors ran away with that game because Klay Thompson got hot. And then Jordan Poole starts to get involved. And then, you know, everything else kind of opens up from there. Wiggins made a few big shots and the route was on. And so I think the Warriors are not as Steph dependent as one might think they are. They can win a game or two with him playing, with him shooting less than his ideal percentages, just because of the pressure that he relieves from his teammates by being on the floor and drawing so much attention. Even if it's Marcus Smart chasing him off every screen, there are going to be times where other players are inching off of their man to help Smart, you know, cover when Curry's coming around on a cut. And that's going to open up lanes for other guys.
So it's probably not good news for the Celtics that Smart is nursing a quad injury.
And you never know how much stock to put in that several days later. You know, they do have a good rest before the finals.
True.
So, you know, if he's hobbled, that's not a good thing. I also tend to think most guys in the finals are dealing with some sort of nagging something at this time of year. So, for the Celtics to win, they need Marcus Smart to be really impactful. They can't have kind of a neutered version of him.
So I think, you know, turning now to the Celtics and how they approach this series, it's, to me, Smart is really essential for this team's recipe for success. Smart needs to be able to really limit Steph Curry. You know, it's kind of like they used to say about Jordan, you can't stop Jordan, you can only hope to contain him. And I think on some level for 7 games, you just hope that you avoid, you know, Curry having one of the, you know, one or more games where he just goes off. And then he's got to be able to do something offensively with Steph, you know, guarding him. But to me, it seems like the combination of Brown and Tatum are really going to be the ones that determine whether or not the Celtics can make a series of this.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts about, you know, what Tatum and Brown bring into this championship game series against the Warriors?
I think I'm more confident that Tatum will show up than Brown. I think Brown is the guy that, I don't think it's a question of can Brown give them 7 great games, but it's more do they get 4 great games out of Jaylen Brown is kind of what they need to win this series, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it just seems like they are more dependent on those two than the Warriors are on their top two. You know, if Klay Thompson has the off night, but Jordan Poole picks up the slack,
mm-hmm.
the Warriors are fine.
Right.
But when Tatum or Brown struggles, the Celtics really don't have other options. I mean, they got a random 30-point game from Al Horford in earlier in the playoffs, but like that's not going to happen on a regular basis. Like they can't look to a guy like that.
Not with Draymond Green, you know.
Right. Exactly. So.
Yeah.
I think Tatum has been the more consistent one. But I think Jaylen Brown, you know, has this upside where he can score 40 points in a playoff game. The issue though is that he's really not comfortable dribbling the ball, kind of to a surprising degree. Mm-hmm. The same can be said about Klay Thompson, but the way Klay scores, he just kind of never needs to. There are guys on the Celtics that it seems like struggle under ball pressure. And so I'm going to be interested if, you know, we mentioned Gary Payton, like he's a much smaller defender than a guy like Jaylen Brown. You would think he's maybe not a good matchup, but if he can hound Jaylen Brown every time that he's dribbling and he's getting his hands in there and he's knocking balls away, like I think that's the ticket is a guy like that who is young, who's never been on the stage before, can you get him a little frustrated? Can you get him a little off to where at the end of the series, we're looking back and we're like, oh, well, Jaylen Brown only shot, you know, 41% during the series. That's why the Celtics lost. You know, that's the kind of thing I would look for as kind of the key matchup to watch.
Yeah. So if you take the trio of Brown and Tatum and Smart, those guys combined are scoring on an average of about 69 points per game. Do you think they need to score above that combined average in order to beat the Warriors, or if they can meet that average that they brought into this series, that they'll have enough firepower on the bench and from guys like Williams and Horford to be able to make this thing happen?
So what was that number again?
So Smart is essentially scoring at about 20 points per game. Brown 23, Tatum 26. So you're talking about 69 points per game for that trio. Is that enough? If they just score their average for each game in this series, is that enough? Or are they going to need to go above and beyond that?
So I think the Warriors are scoring about 111 points a game. I don't know if that's a regular season stat or a playoff stat. But let's just say that that's kind of the baseline.
Let's say, okay, they're playing the top defensive team. So maybe we say 105. Yeah.
So if you're getting, say, 70 points from that trio, then you're still asking Grant Williams, Al Horford, Peyton Pritchard, Derek White. Essentially, those guys have got to find you 35. That seems reasonable to me. Like, I would think if they're getting 70 points a game from their top three guys, that's going to get them in the neighborhood of where they need to be. I think that'll be a good number to follow, Warren, because I don't know if, like, Marcus Smart can average 20 points a game through an NBA Finals. Like, maybe I just have a different opinion of him, but I've never seen him as that kind of offensive player. But you're totally right. That's the type of performances he's been having. So he could prove me wrong, but that would be a surprise to me.
All right, so as we wrap this up, Mark, we'll probably revisit this later in the series, but just to kind of get the conversation going, if the Warriors do win this series, going back to the fact that this is their sixth NBA championship series in the last 8 years, which puts them on the same level as the Chicago Bulls in terms of proficiency in that area. If they win this, where do you kind of rank them, stack them in terms of dynasties over the last 30, 40 years?
Yeah, it's a fascinating question, because they've had this Kevin Durant season in the midst of it. And then they won a title before he was there. They won 73 games before he was there. They made it to the finals the year he got hurt. Now they've made it back to the finals after losing him. So that's a fascinating wrinkle to this whole thing. Whereas there's no other dynasty in comparison where you have, I guess the closest thing would be the Lakers getting back to their, after losing Shaq a few years later, Kobe kind of gets them back.
Yeah. To the finals. That was like a totally different team though.
I mean, it was not the same.
Other than Kobe. Yeah.
The Parker, Ginobili, Duncan, Spurs, David Robinson was on the first team with those guys, but he was the shell of himself by that point. So it would be kind of unprecedented. I don't know how to compare them. Like, are they better than Jordan's Bulls? I don't think so, but no. Are they better than Magic's Lakers? I don't think so. But I think they're in the conversation. I think where you're like, okay, the best teams of the last 40 years are the Bird Celtics, the Magic Lakers, the Jordan Bulls, the Shaq and Kobe Lakers, and the Curry Warriors. Like, you just would kind of recite them off in that same, And I think you'd say them, frankly, before you'd get to any team from LeBron. Maybe I guess you go LeBron's Heat teams, went to four finals in a row and won two back to back. But I, you know, they're going to have a place in history, probably regardless of what happens. But I think certainly if they win a title 2 years after losing Kevin Durant, it only cements their legacy as one of the great dynasties of our era.
Absolutely. Well, let's keep that conversation going. I'm going to do some more thinking and reflecting on that, but it certainly to me is a really, worthy discussion to have, because this is a dynasty that to me is very different than anything we've seen before. And it's everything about the Steph Curry, Golden State Warriors, it looks different. It feels different. And to me, that makes it so much more compelling. So I think there were a lot of people that were kind of, tired of the Golden State Warriors, but maybe the 2 year hiatus has allowed them to feel refreshed about seeing them again in the championship series. But we'll keep a close eye on that. We're going to go ahead and wrap things up, but thank you everybody for listening to the Dog and Duck Show. With that, I'll say go Dogs.
And I'll say go Ducks.
All right. We'll catch you later. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.